Today, I am so pleased to bring you one of, hands down, the best conversations I've ever had on this show. I have been fortunate over the last few years to be in conversation with people in the Titanic and historical and literary community that without the podcast, I might have never had a chance to meet and to learn about and talk to. I'm just forever grateful. Max Miller, who I am speaking with on the pod today, is one of those people. He hosts the YouTube channel Tasting History, where he recreates, researches recipes from all over the world, from multiple time periods going back thousands of years, and tries to get to the root of what those recipes were, how the ingredients were gathered, what they meant to the people that cooked them. And it's just blown up over the last couple of years. He has a huge audience. I'm very fortunate he had the time to talk to me. He's also been on tour recently with a cookbook of the same name. I was a little bit nervous to speak with him. He's a celebrity in my household, as I'm sure he is for many of yours. Many listeners have contacted me over the last couple of years and let me know about his channel and suggested that I speak with him on the pod, and I'm so glad that you did. He does have some Titanic episodes. I will make sure those are linked in the show notes, but he has episodes reaching into the corners of any place or time in history that you might be interested in. I will also make sure to link his cookbook in the show notes. You have to check it out. It's a great addition, not just to your kitchen, but to your bookshelf, to your living room, because there's so much history and so much important dialogue about the things he has researched in that book. I won't ruin anything in the interview. I want you to just hear it and let it unfold. But we talk a lot about what quote unquote mundane history is and why it's really, really important. And I think a lot of the guiding principles behind his work match up with what I do with Titanic. It was just a pleasure to speak with him. I know you're going to enjoy it. So I will get you right there. Enjoy me in conversation with Max Miller of Tasting History. Have a wonderful weekend. There's a little bit at the end if you are looking for some cold weather cocktail or drink ideas for the weekend. There's a little bit at the end for you. And let me know what you think. Talk soon. And Max, thanks again for coming on the pod. All right. I am here with Max Miller of Tasting History. Thank you so much for being here. I told you this before we started recording, but weekly I get messages from listeners requesting that I watch your channel, read your book, have you on the show. And finally, I can say this is happening. And I know listeners are so excited. So if you wouldn't mind, just before we jump into any questions, just kind of a general introduction, just give us a sense of kind of your background and how you created this amazing channel and almost movement. I think what you've done is created this incredible space for people to explore history in a new way, as cheesy as that sounds. So yeah, if you would just kind of give us a quick intro.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it. So I started the channel right at the beginning of the pandemic. It wasn't necessarily because of the pandemic, because I actually started it a week before that all happened. It was very good timing on my end. But I've always loved history since I was a little kid, and I had gotten really into baking specifically after watching the Great British Bake Off. And they used to talk about the history of whatever they were baking on the show. So I would bring in different baked goods to work and that I had made and then talk about the history. And one of my coworkers said, put this up on YouTube. This is interesting. Or put this up on YouTube. Stop telling us. We don't want to hear about it anymore. I'm not sure which one. But so I started putting together a YouTube channel. And the first episode came out a week before, you know, we were all told go home and don't come back. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I got started. But, you know, it has grown so much since then, because when I first started, it was supposed to be mostly food and then just a little bit of history, but it's definitely flipped. And it is a history show with some cooking attached, I feel. You know, it's kind of like history through the lens of cooking. And I've been so pleasantly surprised at how much people are into history, especially when it's told like a story and with, you know, period quotes from people who lived through it and everything. And it's not necessarily done as a textbook. And so I've just been really happy with kind of how it's grown and how people have latched on to the history portion of the show.
I was, I should mention, and I'll hold it up in case we do end up posting the video, but I was going back through your amazing cookbook, which we'll get to, but this is all turned into a book that, you know, I walked into Barnes & Noble to buy, which is incredible. But I noticed that in the opening pages of your book, you talk about this, that what you do is cover history that's not necessarily familiar to us at all. It's the food that you cover is almost the lost history of periods that we study so much in school. I know in the US, if you're you go through typical middle school history, you hit all the high notes of ancient history of, you know, ancient Rome, or once you hit the more modern era, I feel like what you're telling us is the history of what just an average person was doing in their kitchen during these really epic periods that we hear so much of in our typical schooling. Yeah. And you say in the opening of your book, how cuisine can be, I have the quote right here because it's so good, a repository of traditions, mythologies, political turmoil, and societal transformation. And that really strikes a chord with me. It's what I try to do with the podcast, is take little bits of Titanic history and pull them out, you know, from the micro all the way out to the macro, and to cover the histories of people that don't necessarily get covered, and specifically with Titanic for me. But how did you get interested in that? When you started the channel, it sounds like it's evolved a lot, but what was sort of at your core that made you want to tell the histories of forgotten recipes? Many of them were not even properly written down. So you're researching bits and pieces and trying to piece together what they were. Is there a moment that you remember that became a passion for you?
I call it the history of the mundane, because it is... It's not just cooking. I mean, on my show, it is through food, but also I find fascinating the history of clothing and the history of how people slept, their sleeping habits, their daily toiletry habits, you know, how they got ready in the morning, all of that kind of stuff. Because I find that when I'm learning about Napoleon, I can enjoy learning about Napoleon, yes, but I have trouble putting myself, you know, imagining necessarily what it was like for him, because he's just so far removed. He's, you know, kind of one of these lofty gods of history, someone like Napoleon or Caesar or Henry VIII.
They seem almost untouchable in their
and fascinating, yes, but almost like I'm looking at it from the outside. But when you examine the history of the mundane, whether it be one of his soldiers or him, and how he ate, and things that I can immediately latch onto and be like, oh, he was just like me, you know, stars, they're just like us. Okay. Historical figures, they're
the
just
us
like
weekly.
Us.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, exactly. Because even someone like that had to put food in their body every day in order to survive. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's not necessarily learning about the recipes itself, but learning about the people who were making those recipes, the people who were eating these foods. And so, you know, I always start off with the historic recipe, but then by 10 minutes into the episode, we're talking about something that usually has nothing to do with the food anymore. Very often it's about the people who were making it, the people who wrote these things down. or didn't write them down in some cases. And so I've always found that interesting ever since I was a little kid. You know, I loved pretending that I was, like so many of us, I loved pretending like I was one of these figures. You know, I mean, maybe not everyone pretends that they are a sentry at a Civil War armory, which I used to do at my grandpa's house.
You're talking to someone that's been like this since I was about 4 years old too. So but, trust me, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've always found those people's stories just as interesting. Mm-hmm. And I can put myself in their shoes. And so, and I found that if, like you said, you're talking to somebody who is like that, if I am like that, then there are other people who are like that. And there are other people who are going to enjoy learning history in this style. And it turns out, yes, there are millions of people like us. We are a silent army.
Yeah, no, really. And I mean, your show on YouTube, your book have been wildly successful. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of listeners and watchers. And I think it speaks to, you know, I talk about this a lot on the podcast. We're sort of told that in modern culture, expertise and things like this, like history, not cool anymore, right? Like not mainstream, but it totally is, particularly if you get at it in a vein like you have, where people can relate to these, mundane details, but they're not mundane. They're just brilliant and interesting because they become non-mundane when someone like you does this, you know, by showing us these recipes, by connecting all the dots. And so you've been so successful at that, which I'm not surprised. Your show is incredible. How did you zero in on your Titanic episodes? Because, you know, everything you've been saying, it's hard to not interrupt because everything you've said just directly applies to Titanic history as well. You know, when I start to put together an episode, my listeners know this, 9 times out of 10, I end up talking about a lot of not Titanic stuff because the little pieces of Titanic history lead into political histories, micro histories of places. I've done a lot of episodes on food or the drink, things like this, clothing. Were you a Titanic person before, or was it just something that, you know, one day you were kind of going down a list of possible episodes and said like, oh, that would be fun? Or like, what's your background with Titanic, if any?
So it's funny. So when that first episode came out, my brother called me and he was like, 10 seconds in, I could tell that this episode was going to be different because it was Max gets to geek out about one of his favorite topics.
Oh,
Titanic has been one of my favorite things since I was a kid. So I first got into Titanic through a model of the Titanic. I was into building model ships when I was a kid, and my grandpa got me a little model Titanic that was about a foot long, and I built it. And from there, then I ended up building this huge 3-foot model, which was absolutely fantastic. And with it came this booklet that was all about the history of the ship. And it said, when you're putting this piece in, this was, you know, the boiler room where so-and-so happened. And then it would tell a little story about mm-hmm. something that actually happened on the ship. And it allowed me to kind of put myself there and see myself on that little tiny model ship. And so that's when I got into Titanic. And after that, I got pretty much every single book on the subject and watched every movie on the subject multiple times, documentaries. It wasn't that long after. Well, it kind of was. I guess it was about 10 years after Robert Ballard had found the Titanic, you know.
Yeah.
So I was always into it as a little kid. And when I started tasting history, I knew that I was going to be doing Titanic episodes because one of the first, and I say historic cookbooks, it's not a historic cookbook, but it's a cookbook about historic dishes, that I ever got before I even got into cooking was called Last Dinner on the Titanic.
I have it. Yeah.
Brilliant book. The recipes are not period. They're all modernizations of the recipes, but the history in the book is just fantastic and wonderfully written. And I was absolutely obsessed with this book. And so when I started the show, I was like, I'm going to do this, but with, you know, historic recipes and mm-hmm. taking from old cookbooks. But I wanted to wait until because I knew that people were going to enjoy it. And so I wanted to wait until I had an audience so I waited until I hit, I don't know, I think a million or something like that.
Yeah, because you're at what, like 2 million now? I mean, I think
it's, yeah, something, yeah, 2.1. Which, yeah.
Amazing. You knew there was a build, you knew that it was going to be like a reveal, like it is time for the Titanic episodes. Yeah.
Yeah. I felt like people, because again, I had learned that if I am interested in something, other people are probably interested in it as well. And so I didn't know that there were as many Titanic fanatics as I, but there clearly are. And I did take, it was a little scary when I put out that first episode, because I decided that I was going to do an entire month of episodes, and I had never done that really. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, you know, if one episode doesn't do well, I'm kind of screwing myself, because it's already planned out for the whole rest of the month. So I ended up doing 6 episodes back to back, which I've never done and probably will never do again, because it is scary.
I imagine they were wildly successful from what I gather. I mean, I receive emails about those episodes all the time. My husband, he's a software engineer. He works with someone who, he's going to be very excited that I got to talk to you. One of his friends he works with has followed your channel and made almost every recipe that you have made.
Oh, wow.
Over the course. Yeah. So I'm going to be a little bit of a celebrity this afternoon in his work channel. So it's not surprising. Titanic is just one of those things. Of course, my whole podcast is about the cultural history of it. It's one of those things that I just feel, no matter what country you're in, no matter like what language you speak, what your background is, there's a chance that it's a bonding thing. I've long had this theory that you could take 10 complete strangers of all different ages, races, nationalities, but if they all like Titanic, put them in a room, an hour later, they will be planning a group vacation together. It's such a bonding thing. So you did, and obviously I'll be linking all of this in the show notes. So you did first class, second class, and third class meals. Mm-hmm. And then you also did a crew meal, and then you also did some beverages. Remind me, which did you do? Punch romaine? What was the? So
I did punch romaine. I also did a cocktail, and talked about the baker.
Oh, that's right. Oh, Jochen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, so again, with my show, sometimes there's a bit of a, I have to kind of twist things, because we don't have any recipes from, or even know exactly what the crew members were eating. Mm-hmm. But I knew I wanted to do an episode talking about the crew members and how they ate, because we know where they ate and their daily routine and everything. So I think that their recipe was actually from the third class or second class. And it was like something that they would have been making. There's always a bit of a...
It's hard with the Titanic. I think there's this misconception that we just have all of the recipes. We don't. No, not at all. And I've had Veronica Hinke on the show. She did, you know, last night on the Titanic, and then she did the Titanic movie tie-in cookbook. And, you know, she's talked about this on the show. We don't have those recipes. So when you open up a book or open up like something like you've done, it is painstaking research to try to recreate or put together. So what was that process like? Was there, I mean, not to put you on the spot, but was there like one moment in the Titanic research with the second class or the third class where it was difficult to piece together what you wanted to do? Like, what was that experience like trying to get these recipes and stay true to what you felt like was the most authentic experience?
So the first and second class were easier in a way, because while we don't have exact recipes that were used on the ship, we do know that all of the food was based, especially from the restaurant, which they actually called, many passengers called the Ritz restaurant, the a la carte restaurant on the ship. They were all based on the food that was going around Paris, London, and New York in the top restaurants, namely the Ritz, Delmonico's, you know, places like that, the Savoy. And so many of those recipes come from Escoffier, who you know, was just the titan, if you will, of food at the time. And so he did have a cookbook. And so we did have all of those recipes. So while it may, you know, perhaps very likely the chefs on the Titanic took liberties and made adjustments and things like that, they were still going to be very similar to what Escoffier was making. And we do know what he was making. So that was easier. When it came to the third class, it's a little more difficult because it's a lot of those recipes weren't written. They're not even recipes, you know, kippers. There isn't a recipe necessarily for kippers.
Yeah.
Especially from the period, you know, it's like, oh, well, it's just fried or it's just boiled or it's. So I did have to kind of, and we only have, you know, their one menu. So I had to find something that was a little bit more complex than just, you know, bacon. And that was the rice soup. And there are recipes from the period for different rice soups. So I just chose one of those from a working class style meal.
And speaking of the working class, and that's part of the mystery here, I'm sure not just in the third class Titanic, but in a lot of what you do, that, like we mentioned at the beginning, you know, history is, you say it in your book, history is written by people who wrote things down. So if you, mm-hmm. if you were someone who was maybe not even literate, but just, you know, a person, a woman or a man in their kitchen and say 1842 or, you know, fill in any year, you weren't necessarily writing your family's recipes down. You may not have been able to write, but that doesn't mean that you weren't an amazing cook and people clamored to eat your food. And so, you know, like you say in your book, not, I mean, 80 or 90% of what we could know about food for an average person in any period has unfortunately been lost. And, you know, something I actually just recently rewatched the rice soup one in preparation for talking to you. And that's such a good one to mention because it shows the research that you do. It shows like what it takes to bring this to people, to create an episode like you do. And it's also a good example of a food of the people that probably many people in their kitchen were riffing on, I would imagine. You know, it's mm-hmm. like one of those recipes that was probably very traditional in an average household, but everyone's mother or grandmother had their own way of doing it, which is which is just so fun to think about. I have a couple of fun questions from my Patreon members. They're just kind of general, but one I thought was so good, and it's my listener, Scott. What is your opinion on not just with Titanic food, but any of it, how differently, this is such a good question, how differently do you think things taste before the addition of preservatives? This is what he was asking is, you know, we can recreate a recipe now, but a lot of the ingredients we're buying at our grocery store have new preservatives, things are made differently. So just in your opinion, how close can we actually get to how things tasted? The addition of preservatives, I imagine, has changed how our taste buds experience everything.
But preservatives is huge.
Yeah, I know. It's it's such an all-encompassing term.
Salt and sugar were the main preservatives for a very long time, which obviously greatly changed the flavor of food. I mean, salt pork, you have to rinse for hours just to get it palatable. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about like modern preservatives that aren't naturally used typically for food, I think it's hard to tell how they've changed the flavors because we don't know. We do know that they do change the flavors. They, you know, companies strive for them not to, but they absolutely do. In some ways, often they change the textures of things. That's actually a big thing. But even without preservatives, we still can't tell what things tasted like. Because even going back 100 years, honestly, even 50 or 60 years in many cases, every single ingredient has changed. And so, I mean, even wheat is not the same as it was 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. No meat is going to be the same because our animals eat different things. Or even if they are eating, you know, just grass fed, that grass has different contaminants and microplastics in the water. And there are just, there's no way to go back even 100 years, let alone we want to go back 1,000 years. It's just impossible. So as frustrating as that is, I mean, on the show, I'm not too much of a stickler about that because there's just no way to really capture those old flavors.
There's no way. I was thinking about this just the other day. My husband and I recently started watching Outlander because we're going to Scotland this summer. Well, for years, people had told me I should watch Outlander just because of who I am. And I sort of resisted. I'm if someone recommends it too much, I get very, closed off. So we finally gave in. But I was thinking about this because there was a scene with like the porridge. And, I turned to my husband and I said, I think if I time traveled to 1742, I would lose like 30 pounds because I can't eat any of this that they're, just like the big hunks of meat with no seasoning and the porridge that's liquid and it's got gloop in it. But I was thinking about this because there's no way I could ever imagine what that porridge in that pot tasted like, because the pot is its own, it's an iron pot, is its own character, and the ingredients in it are their own character. And that's what you're doing. That's a perfect example. You are going in surgically almost to moments like that and saying, hey, let's try to get as close as we possibly can to this.
Yeah.
To understand this person's experience. And
it's always an approximation. And especially on my show, because I do, there are historic cooking shows that use historic cooking methods over an open fire and things like that. But they typically focus on one time period, just 18th century or just medieval, because the methods of cooking changed. So you'd have to have I cover all time period. So I would have to have like 40 kitchens in my house to really approximate that.
No, you'd have to have a whole complex, a filming complex where you went to one Wouldn't set after nice. The other. Yeah.
That'd be nice. But also, and this was not by design, but by the fact that I started this during the pandemic when I was locked in my condo, everything I strive for you to be able to make at home in your kitchen.
Yeah.
So I'm never going to say, and then you build a giant open fire and take this. You're just not going to see that on the show.
Safe liability issues. Yeah. It's very, what you do is very accessible. I think that you're right. That's the beauty of it. And like you said, I think more people are clamoring for their history than we realize. I think that we just have to be creative and innovative about how we present it to people. But I think people are clamoring for this and to know more about how people lived in the past. Before we kind of leave Titanic specifically, another question, this is from Claire, a listener of mine. She asked specifically about the Café Parisien, but you may not remember exactly what was on the menu there. I don't want to put you on the spot. But her question was, in thinking about the Titanic recipes, the restaurants on board, you specifically, especially now I know you're a Titanic person, her question was, if you could go back and you could order one thing at a restaurant on Titanic, what would it be? Do you have a dream scenario if you could time slip for like 20 minutes and order something on the ship, what would it be?
Oh gosh, there are so many things.
Or it could be a drink, or it could be just an experience. Like for me, I would love to like sit there in the afternoon with like a hot tea and people watch. Like when people ask me if I could time travel to Titanic, that's always my answer, is I want to be at the Veranda Cafe, with a hot beverage and just watch as people walk by. Because to me, to be honest, the Titanic menus, I've tried a lot of the things, and I've been to recreation dinners and such. And I don't know that I've ever run across anything that's really, they're interesting. It's so interesting, but I don't know that it's things that I necessarily crave for a time travel experience.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely think that the Veranda Cafe, just sitting in an afternoon and seeing all of the people walk by in their clothes. But I also would love a first class dinner. and seeing the clothing,
like the full experience
that yeah. they wore, and the setup, and getting to use the grape scissors. When it comes to the food specifically, the things that I wanted to try the most, I made on the show, I have to say. But I would love to try the Waldorf pudding, which was served on the 14th in the first class.
Oh, yeah.
It was one of the last courses, because I don't know what it is. There are different things that were called this, but they're all somewhat unique and different. So I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah, I've only ever just like seen it written down. Wait, speak to that a little bit if you don't mind, because I've only ever just like looked at it on the menu. So there's different interpretations of what this even is.
I've seen different interpretations, and you know, it's probably named after the Waldorf Hotel. Probably.
Yeah.
But an exact recipe, I haven't been able to find. Maybe there is one out there that is like, yes, this is a Waldorf pudding, but I've not been able to find exactly that. So curious how it was served, and surely it was done with some sort of custard on top, and you know.
Oh yeah, the custards, jellies, the peaches and chartreuse jelly. I highly recommend people go and watch that episode of yours. I have to say, I'm kind of glad I live in a place and a time where jellied things are not really. Really my cup of tea, I don't think. But in terms of, I've got to ask this. In terms of Titanic, especially since you are a Titanic person going way back. Is there a specific person, passenger, crew member that is your favorite? When I meet other Titanic people, it tends to be the case that we all sort of have our couple of people that we love to study or really are kind of special in our heart because their story has felt, you know, relatable or whatever it may be. Do you have any passengers or crew that stick with you?
Charles Dauphin, I think, the baker.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just his, everything about his story, I love. And he sounds like, you know, a good guy. You know, throwing deck chairs over just so people would have something to cling on to. And, you know, I don't know. I like him. I like his style.
Yeah, he seems like the real deal. I actually get angry when I have heard, you know, podcasts that have done one-off episodes on Titanic or whatever it may be. And it's, they get to jock in, they mention him briefly and they say, no way he was in the water that long. No way the drinking thing's right. And I mean, that part, those aren't really the important parts. The important parts are that he truly was a hero that night. Yeah. And, you know, and sometimes with Titanic, there's so much mythology that you have to sort of tear that away and pull back like layers of curtains to get to someone's actual story. And I'm constantly amazed when I sit down. I did an episode on Jochen last year. When I sit down to do research, I'm always amazed. Oh, like we actually have the information on this person. It's just that a lot of people have chosen to use the mythology and keep that going instead of taking the time to go through the census records, go through newspaper articles, you know, we have the information. It's there.
Yeah.
So tell me about kind of moving a little bit off of Titanic, but I'm just so intrigued by what you do. So when you were putting the book together, it's amazing. Like I was going through and I found myself on the page about the placenta cake and I just was like, what is, it's so intriguing. And I've never heard about this, known about this, but you have recipes covering centuries and centuries. Tell us a little bit about how the book Tasting History came into being and what the process was like of putting that together. I imagine a lot of time in the kitchen and also a lot of time just in research.
Yeah. So the book is in a large part taken from the show.
Yeah.
So the majority of recipes in the book I had already done for the show. So the research had been done. There was a lot more testing that needed to be done because when I do the show, I will make the recipe usually once. And that's what I'm tasting on camera. It's let me see what following their exact recipe will turn out. The only time that I remake something is if something goes, you know, horribly wrong and I know
or
that,
burns,
oh, this is supposed like to be a bread and yet it is still liquid. Then I know I have made a mistake or the recipe was so poorly written, yeah. Which often happens. But with the cookbook, it did require a lot more recipe testing by me, and I have a Patreon, and my patrons were fantastic about helping with the recipes.
Awesome. Okay, that's yeah. So cool. Yeah.
A big thing for the cookbook was, one, figuring out what recipes I wanted to include, you know, to have a fair amount of desserts and appetizers and drinks and entrees, and then also learning how to actually write a recipe, because just like anything, it is a skill. And it turns out it is a skill that I don't have and that I don't have time to learn, because it really seems like, oh, you could learn that in a couple of days. No, it is a very complex thing to really be able to write a recipe so people can follow it and have it consistent over an entire cookbook. So recipe one and recipe 50 are written in the same style. So I have a co-author, Anne Folkbein, who does that. She takes recipes from cooks and then formats them correctly and really makes it so that they definitely work, you know, on the page and everything. So she really helped. I'm just starting a second cookbook right now, and it is not based on the show. I mean, it's the same conceit that I'm using old recipes, but I'm really focusing more on the history of old cookbooks specifically. And so it's starting from zero, and it's going to require a lot of recipe testing on my part and everything. And so
I'm very excited. There's another book. I know you probably can't say much about it, but is it similar in form and it's just new recipe? I mean, is there any kind of new hook to it, or is it, it's basically just a continuation of what you're doing, just new recipe? Is it going to cover like similar time periods and places?
So, I'm not entirely sure, because it really is in the very early stages.
Absolutely in development, yeah.
But at this point in time, while we are recording this, the plan is that instead of necessarily the history of different dishes and everything like that, which I cover in the first book, it's really going to be more, I am picking 70 or 80 of the most important cookbooks throughout history. Okay, that cool. I find important for any given reason, and cooking something from those, and especially trying to get, I mean, there will be a lot, of course, from England and France and Italy and America, because we have such a cookbook writing tradition, but I definitely want to really focus on other parts of the world where, you know, maybe their first cookbook isn't even in existence until the 1940s or 50s, which is common for most parts of the world. But I still want to cook from those. And so I'll talk more about the history of those cookbooks and the influence that they had on the cuisine.
That's such an amazing concept. I can't wait. Listeners know this, but my sort of side research project that's eventually going to turn into my main again, and what I went to grad school for is history of the U.S. South and U.S. slavery, pre-Civil War, also post-Civil War, and Reconstruction. But I think about it all the time when I'm reading in that vein, that the recipes of slaves, I mean, talk about a whole, I mean, it's such a, I think about all the time how many recipes were in someone's head, but not written down. I mean, that's, and you could take that example or 1,000 different examples of cultures, places, where cookbooks maybe didn't exist. And like you're saying, until much later when someone took notes or took old books and put it together and finally published it. But it just is this huge like cave in my mind that I'm constantly exploring, which is why your channel and what you do is so fun to get to witness and be a part of, because I think there's so much of history that has yet to even be recorded. And mm-hmm. So what you're doing is actually such important work. You're almost in many of these, you're recording history for people that didn't have a chance to write things down, that didn't have a chance to talk about what was in their kitchen or what they were doing. And it's really incredible. And you've traveled. I follow you on Instagram. You've traveled with this, right? I mean, this book has taken you all around the world, which is so exciting. Can you speak just a little bit about what that was like, or even just a, you know, one memory from your travels last year? Just, I imagine you probably pinched yourself. I would. I just, seeing where you got to travel, it was an incredible journey. If you would like to speak on that a tiny bit, would be amazing.
Yeah. So the book tour itself went all over the US, you know, back east, Chicago, and through the West Coast. But then I've also been able this year to go to Austria and Greece and several other places where it wasn't necessarily for the book, but I either was meeting up with people to sign books or, you know, or doing some research for future episodes. I mean, it's a blast. I love travel. It's kind of what I would do all the time if I could. But my favorite part of it was actually getting to meet people who watch the show, because making a YouTube videos, it's a very insular profession. I rarely leave the room that I'm in right now, except to go to the kitchen and back. So I don't meet anyone. I have no coworkers except for my cats. And so I've only met, you know, oh, this is one person who has watched the show, and I'll meet them out when I'm grocery shopping or something. But to get to do these signings where hundreds of people who watch the show every single Tuesday are there to meet me and talk about food history, it was surreal and just so much fun. And honestly, you know, seeing a million people watch this video or meeting 50 people who watch this video, it's more impactful to me to meet 50 people rather than just see the number, a million people have watched this video, just see the number on the screen, you know.
Absolutely.
To actually get to meet the people who watch, it's really awesome.
Yeah, there's such a good, like, heartfelt feeling when you meet people that, I mean, obviously, if someone watches your show, they share a love of history. They share a love of the, you know, I have had that experience. And I did a live show in Michigan last year, and I was walking into a restaurant that was right by the hotel where it was happening. So that's not weird. It's not like I was truly a celebrity or anything. I'm not in the least. But in the Titanic community, I have like a little niche a bit. And so I was walking into a restaurant, and I swear, across the restaurant, I suddenly hear, that LA Beatles. Anyway, it was just like a surreal moment. And someone who was there for the show at the hotel was eating at the same restaurant. But it was the first moment where I started this during COVID. So the first year I did this, I didn't get to meet anybody or do anything in person, you know, so it was still surreal to meet people in person. But that was the moment for me where it was like, wow, like, this person takes the time to listen to the show, puts it in their ears, you know, wants to converse with me, wants to have this common interest. And I agree. I would, you know, when I started the podcast, I said, if I have 3 people that love it and message me and want to talk about it, then that's meaningful. And that's all that matters. And I truly mean that. I tear up sometimes when I think about it. I've had such amazing interactions with people all over the world by doing this. So I can't even imagine how many amazing interactions that you've had. Do you feel like there is a favorite? This is sort of a geeky question that probably a third grader would ask you, but I just have to ask it. In all of your work, you know, is there an era that you feel most at home in? Like, is there one where, you know, when you sit down and you work on a recipe from it, or you're working on a show, you know, new script, whatever it may be, that you're just, you guys get giddily excited inside because you're in that era? Is there one that really means a lot to you just personally, like a country or a time period, anything like that?
There are a few. You know, honestly, I kind of get obsessed with whatever I'm working on to a degree, but there are those that I keep returning to because I do just love putting myself in the shoes of those people. That would be Victorian England, really anything late Georgian through Victorian England, the American Civil War, Titanic, very obviously, and medieval Europe in general. Just, I love the Middle Ages. I love,
I remember being the same. I remember being like in seventh grade, and if we got to, you know, Middle Ages unit, I was so, you know, it's like, there's nothing better. And everybody else in the class is like grumbling, like, oh, you know, I'm going to do this. And I'm like at the, you know, the front of the class, I'm taking my little notes, and, you know, and I still do that. I'm the same. I just, whatever I happen to be working on, I still go old school, like scribble copious notes on a notepad and that sort of thing. Yeah, we match up very well. Those are pretty much mine too. Yeah. So, well, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And I think that in terms, it's like what we were talking about earlier. I think that people want to get at history through these little human moments. You know, I talk about it a lot on the podcast, whether it's something someone was eating or something they were wearing. And this is what you're doing, is you're really giving us not a history of just food or drink, but just humanity and these little moments. Or you can imagine somebody in their kitchen, you know, whether it was in, you know, 1200 or, you know, 10 years ago. So I did want to end with a fun question. And if it takes a minute for you to think of something, I can edit this part out. Okay. But I'm a cocktail person, and you do beverages and cocktails. And this is probably going to post headed into a weekend. And a lot of the country's got some, you know, we've got winter weather going on right now. It's snowing right here. I'm in North Carolina. What's your favorite historic drink or cocktail? You have one to recommend if someone's listening to this and then they're like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go put on Tasting History and put my feet up and drink a cocktail or just any. Do you have a recommendation if someone's in that mode after they listen to this?
My favorite historic cocktail?
Mm-hmm.
You know, cocktails, a lot of them are still around today. So just a hot buttered rum actually is one of my favorites. And going back to an older recipe that actually uses butter, because a lot of modern versions, they leave out the butter.
Yeah, doesn't make any sense. Okay.
Yeah. So a hot buttered rum on a hot day. But when it comes to my favorite cocktail just ever, and I'm going to be doing a video on this in the not too distant future.
Oh, cool.
Is the pina colada.
Oh,
I
okay.
Love, because I like sitting on a, actually, I don't like sitting on the beach. I like sitting at a bar next to the beach and drinking a pina colada. Yeah.
No, I'm the same way. I'm not outdoorsy. I call myself like outside-y. Like I like to be outside. Yeah. I'm more the one that wants to be up at the bar. So that's fun. So you're going to do an episode about the sort of history of that one. And
yeah, because we're getting ready to go to Puerto Rico, where it was invented, so they say. So I'll go through kind of the history and see if I can't make one of those early recipes.
And back to the hot buttered rum, and I apologize, I should know this. Do you have a video or an entry on that?
I actually don't, but I do have something similar that is historic that you will not find today. And that is buttered beer. It was like one of my very first episodes.
Oh, cool. Okay. People can go back and find that. Yeah.
Yeah. Buttered beer. You know, a lot of people know it from Harry Potter, but it was a real thing. And it is made with beer and it is made with butter. And it is interesting. And it's actually quite good if it's done correctly, but it's also very easy to curdle the eggs that are also in it. So you got to be careful.
Oh my gosh. This sounds like something that I would just mess up epically. So I don't know. I know my husband can help me. He's more logistical and he's good with specifics like that. Have you done, this is a selfish question to end on. Have you done any Scotland Outlander era? Have you done anything in that era?
I have, not necessarily talking about Outlander or those wars, but I did one on the cattle of Scotland, and specifically some of the cattle thieves of Scotland, which were very big in the 18th.
I have not seen that one. I've got to find it. Okay. Century.
Yeah. The dish that I made for that episode is Toad in the Hole.
Oh, yeah. I know what that is.
And
yeah.
Then, okay. And then I did a haggis episode, and I've done an episode on Macbeth and what he would have eaten. Again, much, much earlier than Outlander, but still Scotland based at least. And then I did an episode on the history of Scottish whiskey, Scotch.
I do think I've seen that one. Yeah. We're trying to give ourselves a little bit of we've always been whiskey people, but headed into our trip, we're going to go to Islay and spend a few days there and go to like Lagavulin and Lafroig. And so we're trying to give ourselves an education on all of that. I could talk for years. I appreciate everything that you do. I mean, what you're doing for the historical community, for, you know, the YouTube space, and for really, I mean, I'll be frank, for providing extremely researched and high quality content for people like us, history lovers that want that. I mean, we live in a world where everything's like 2 minutes this, 2 minute 30 seconds, yeah, you know, buzzword. But what you're doing is researched and thoughtful, and your book is just glorious to go through. And I've been telling people, I've had people over at my house since I've had it out, and oh my gosh, and like thumbing through it. It's a great book to have out, not just to cook for, like from, but also to like have on your dining table, yeah, and just talk
coffee
about
table
and absolutely. And yeah, absolutely. Or coffee table, sorry. My children
or
are
dining
home
table,
on a,
either one.
Yeah. My children are home for on a weather day, and so my brain is broken. It's been a crazy morning. But yes, it's a great coffee table book too. I hope we get to sit down again at some point for some reason. I hope it happens, because this has just been a delight, and would love to do it again sometime, and can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely.